Support for KPLU and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, with a reminder that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Okay, well, are we ready to switch gears? Happy Monday. This is a news meeting. We have 1 week left of January.
It is not Monday. It is Saturday, as you probably know, and we are pulling back the curtain a little bit here on Sound Effect today from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this voice that you're hearing is executive producer and news director Aaron Hennessy.
All right.
Sounded good.
Maybe you have a weekly team meeting or something like that at your office. Well, this is ours. It's Mondays at 9:40, and all the reporters and hosts and producers gather around to map out the week.
I'd like to hear a quick recap of the reporters' week two this time, because we've got all sorts.
So regular listeners will probably recognize a few of these voices there in the background. You know, we've got Kirsten.
So Art and I have a regular taping this week, and
Ed Ronco.
All right.
Things considered.
Kind of a wacky week. Zoe was going to be here today working.
And of course, we've got all of our reporters. There's Bellamy and Ashley and Paula and Jennifer. Their number one job is to cover their beats, which is environment or business or criminal justice. But besides staying up on all the latest news, sometimes they wander off the beaten path just a little for some more unusual stories. And often, that's where we come in. So for today's show, we are going to... Well, okay, as I did in the meeting, I think I'm just going to let senior producer Arwin Nix spell this out.
Okay, let's move on to Sound Effect.
Sound Effect this week is highlighting the great works of all of you from the newsroom. We are going to be playing some of our, there's a lot of favorites, but we're going to be playing some of our favorite pieces from the newsroom that have contributed to Sound Effect, including Arbor Jane, Male Birth Control, GI Newspapers, Video Game Voices, and either Steve or Mama Tits, depending on time and depending on a couple other things.
So, yeah, what she said. Today on Sound Effect, we bring you some of our favorites from the resourceful and talented reporters here at KPLU. We're going to head up into the treetops, down into the foxholes, and even burrow into a dystopian video game. It's Newsroom Appreciation Day here on Sound Effect. Don't go away.
Work hard, have fun.
Chapter 1, General Assignment. KPLU's Jennifer Wing is one of those reporters you can throw onto just about any kind of story, whether it's education or politics or business. And in this case, it's the intersection of science, history, and sex. For decades, researchers have been trying to create a birth control pill for men. And believe it or not, the male birth control pill actually did exist. In fact, it predated the birth control pill for women. It looked like a game changer. And scientists here in Seattle were really close to making that a reality. But in the end, they were thwarted. Here's Jennifer to explain how it happened.
Back in the early 1960s, researchers from the University of Oregon and the University of Washington created a pill that stopped the production of sperm. You see, doctors were developing drugs to treat worms in people, and when they were testing the drugs out on lab animals, mice, rats, they couldn't breed them anymore.
No one knew how they worked. But they thought, well, this could be actually a wonderful male contraceptive.
That's Dr. John Amory, a professor of medicine at the University of Washington.
So they started testing them in more species, and eventually they tested them in humans. And they worked well in humans. They were free of side effects. They didn't affect sexual function, hormone levels. And the investigators thought, wonderful, here we have this drug. We don't know the mechanism, but it seems to safely and effectively suppress sperm counts, and then when we take the drug away, the sperm production comes back.
The drug was called WIN-18446, and I wondered, you know, women are so used to the idea of taking a birth control pill. Would guys be up for this if they had the option? Would they bear the responsibility of taking a wind pill?
Knowing that it wouldn't lead to pregnancy.
Yes! In a heartbeat. Yes!
This is Blake Saunders from Kirkland and Marisha Madrono of Seattle. I talked to them outside of a bar in Wallingford.
If you take it if you think you're going to have sex, right?
Nope.
You take it every day the same way as a woman takes a birth control pill. I like it.
Yes.
This is how most of the men reacted when they heard about WIN-18446. Tons of enthusiasm. So how did scientists back in the early 1960s know that WIN worked on people? Well, Dr. Amory says the experiments with the WIN pill
were actually being performed in prisoners. It was common at the time. It's no longer done. They were thought to be ideal candidates because they were in one place, they wouldn't disappear. If something happened, you'd know about it in terms of safety.
Things were going great. 50 to 100 men were taking the drug for about a year with no horrible side effects, and then
they discovered that there was a real catch.
Alcohol. You could not take this drug if you drank alcohol.
They found this out just by coincidence. One of the inmates flagged down Dr. Alvin Paulson, who was an investigator at the University of Washington for many years in this area, and said, "You guys have a real problem. You can't drink when you take this drug." And Dr. Paulson said, "Oh, come on, you know, you were probably drinking cleaning fluid or something in the prison." And the prisoner shook his head, and he pulled out a flask of Jack Daniel's whiskey that had been smuggled into him. And then it was there that they realized they had a problem.
When WIN and alcohol mix, something called acetaldehyde, which is in the same family as formaldehyde, builds up in the body, making you feel violently ill.
You start sweating.
You vomit.
Actually, a few people have even died from these reactions. So it's not trivial.
While the WIN pill was successfully stopping the production of sperm, bringing male testicles back to their prepubescent state, taking them from the size of kiwis down to small plums, it was also blocking an enzyme in the liver. The body couldn't metabolize alcohol and flush it out. Back at the bar, Blake Saunders is having second thoughts.
Honestly, if it made me violently ill, if I drank and took this, probably would not take it.
I can tell he really wants this to work.
So my question then comes, can you smoke weed? Can you take Vicodin? What vices can I use whilst on it?
Dr. Amory is looking into this, an effective pill for men that could accommodate indulgences. After studying the original WIN experiments, he focused on what the drug did right, the chemistry that was stopping the male body from making sperm.
So what the WIN drug was doing was blocking the conversion of vitamin A, something we all have in our diets, to its active form, retinoic acid.
Testicles need retinoic acid to make sperm. No retinoic acid, no sperm.
Your testis is a very interesting sight in that it can't take up retinoic acid from the circulation. It has to make it locally. And what does the testis do with retinoic acid? Well, we're still learning about this. But we do know that in the absence of retinoic acid, you can't make sperm. And that is now our target for developing novel drugs as male contraceptives, hopefully that can reversibly suppress sperm production without causing the alcohol-related side effects.
The drug Dr. Amory and his colleagues are trying to create would act as a key, turning off the production of retinoic acid and stopping the male reproductive system's factory, which makes 1,000 sperm every minute. So when are we going to get a male pill?
You know, I think we're looking at least at 5 and 10 years. If we can get a compound that's effective with daily oral dosing, my next dream is to develop an implant based on the same molecular entity that could be put in a man, and then he could just forget about it for a couple years. I have two young sons, 10 and 12, and I think, God, I hope, wouldn't it be great to just send him to college with one of these 4-year implants?
Whatever comes to market will be safer than the option for women. You see, women who take a pill or have a hormonal implant, we have a greater chance of having a stroke or getting blood clots. In the world of pharmaceuticals, those risks are considered to be okay because the other option, being pregnant, puts a woman in a whole new category of complicated health problems. Taking a pill is safer than being pregnant, and for many, the convenience birth control offers is worth the potential hazards. Dr. Amory says you can't make the same justification for a man's contraceptive.
Because the man is not the individual who's bearing the risks of the pregnancy. So the bar for safety for a male contraceptive is extremely high because you're thinking about giving a drug to millions of otherwise healthy young men. So we can't have things like blood clots or strokes, even in a very small percentage of those men, because we can't justify that risk because they're not the ones who are bearing the similar risks, the higher risks of pregnancy.
When Dr. Amory figures all of this out, he'll have at least one man waiting in line to take the pill.
Yes! In a heartbeat.
That story from KPLU's Jennifer Wing. You can learn more about the male contraceptive at kplusoundeffect.org. Coming up, we'll head into the trenches with some subversive GIs, and then the cake. Well, the cake is a lie. We'll find out more on Sound Effect from KPLU. Don't go away. Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Today, all of our stories come from KPLU's newsroom. Chapter 2, Business and Labor. So a big and growing business here in the Puget Sound region is gaming. And when you hear that, you might picture pale people in a dim room writing code. But the video game industry reaches into all kinds of unexpected places here, including into the lives of a husband and wife who never imagined that they would become huge stars in the gaming world. KPLU's Ashley Gross makes introductions.
Ellen McLean has had a long career as an opera singer. But now, this is what she's famous for.
Here's an interesting fact. You're not breathing real air. It's too expensive to pump this far down.
That is McLean doing the voice of GLaDOS. GLaDOS is the sweet-sounding but passive-aggressive computer in the games Portal and Portal 2. McLean's husband, John Patrick Lowry, began his career as a guitar composer. But he's now famous for doing the voice of the snarky Australian sniper in the game Team Fortress 2.
Professionals have standards. Be polite. Be efficient. Have a plan to kill everyone you meet.
These games are blockbusters. If you're 20 years old, you've probably played them. So this is a story of unlikely fame for a couple now in their early 60s. The video game industry was embryonic when McLean and Lowry moved to Seattle from New York in 1989.
You know, we just packed up a truck, we packed up that old piano, and we just moved out, and our first gig here, our first gig here, was packing fish eggs.
At a salmon egg factory.
For Cossack Caviar.
That's
I don't
right.
know if they still exist.
Right.
Their careers on stage started to take off. McLean got lots of opera roles in Seattle and Tacoma. Lowry decided to focus on acting instead of composing, and he put together a voice demo and did some instructional videos and things for Boeing. And then his agent sent him on video game auditions.
The first video game I did was a thing called the Spy Fox Breakfast Cereal.
What did your agent say, and what was your reaction?
Oh, well, the agent doesn't say anything. The agent said, hey, I got an audition for you tomorrow at, 3:30. It was just a video game. It's like, oh, okay, cool. I mean, it didn't matter. It was like it was a gig.
In those days, the mid-90s, game developers were not too sophisticated. Lowry says they'd hand him some lines to read with absolutely no direction. One time, he remembers his line was simply, goodbye, son.
And I said, why am I saying goodbye to him? And what's going on? Call up the writer and say, Okay, so what's happening? This is a place where the game branches, and your son is either going to, go down to the store and be right back, or he's going to step through this interdimensional gateway and go to another universe, and you're never going to see him again. So could you say it in a way that would work either way? So I said, goodbye, son. Great, that's great. That'll work fine.
Lowry says developers began to realize they needed to give more direction to the actors if they wanted sophisticated cinematic games. Lowry told his wife to audition, but McLean was reluctant at first.
I hear all the ads on the radio, and I hear all the voiceover work, and it's male-dominated. And it's still male dominated.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, why should I do this? I'd never get work. Well, never say never.
Initiating surprise in 3, 2, 1.
They told the actors who were auditioning to sound as much like this computer-generated voice as you possibly could.
I feel awful about that surprise. Tell you what, let's give your parents a call right now.
In Portal, GLaDOS the computer has you do puzzles in the name of science, but you slowly start to discover she is not on your side. She keeps promising you cake if you'll do what she says. Finally, to win, you, the gamer, have to find GLaDOS and destroy her. And even then, while the credits are rolling, GLaDOS taunts you with a song called Still Alive.
Can you leave me? I am still alive. I'm doing science and I'm still alive.
24 hours after the game was released, 24 hours, we'd never gotten a fan email before. We got a fan email from Denmark saying, people are in the streets of Copenhagen chanting, the cake is a lie, the cake is a lie. And it's like, oh my gosh, I'm married to a world famous person now.
But Lowry's famous too, not just for the sniper, but also for Pudge the Butcher in the game Dota 2. At gaming conventions, people wait for hours for their autographs. And podcasters from as far away as India do gushing interviews.
Guys, welcome to the show where we talk to Pudge.
Oi, hello. You know what I like? I like fresh meat.
Oh my God, I've got goosebumps. If you can see here, I've got goosebumps. This guy is phenomenal.
For McLean and Lowry, this is all a little bizarre. McLean doesn't even play video games. She likes bridge. But now they have this link to a younger generation. And sometimes, just for fun, they reveal their video game alter egos to random strangers.
I'll see, say, a 17-year-old boy walking down the street, and as I go by, I'll say, we're a lot alike, you and I. You tested me. I tested you. You killed me. Oh, wait a minute. I guess I haven't killed you yet. Well, food for thought. And I totally blow their mind.
So how does it feel to have this be what you're famous for? I mean,
it's miraculous to me.
Surreal.
McLean and Lowry say they never could have imagined this career for themselves, but they say it's fun and gratifying to play the characters so many people around the world love or love to hate.
This was a triumph. I'm making a note here, huge success. It's hard to overstate my satisfaction. Aperture Science. We do what we must because we can. For the good of all of us, except the ones who are dead. But there's no sense.
That story from KPLU business and labor reporter Ashley Gross.
Keep on trying till you run out of cake. And the science gets done, and you make a neat con for the people who are still alive.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect, and we are spinning some of our favorite tales from KPLU's newsroom today. And now we're on to Chapter 3, Law and Justice. This story is about people who broke the rules to do what they saw as the right thing. But they were in the military, so breaking the rules had especially harsh consequences. In the late 1960s and the early 70s, there were all these underground newspapers. Most of them had a counterculture or anti-war flavor. And one of those papers, called Fed Up, was created mainly by and for members of the military. It was published in Tacoma near Fort Lewis from 1969 to 1973. KPLU's Paula Whistle tracked down some copies of the paper and a few of the people behind it.
What do we have here on the table?
Well, I have assembled some of the archives from the coffee house.
Stan Anderson's dining room table is covered in old GI underground newspapers from around the country. He's clearly a guy who likes to keep stuff. His house is filled with anti-war posters and such. During the Vietnam War, he was just out of the Army when he helped set up the Shelter Half Coffee House in Tacoma.
You can see in this picture that I have in front of me, the Shelter Half in 1968, it shows some round tables with GIs sitting around it.
Soldiers could come in, hang out, play music, and help put together the underground newspaper known as Fed Up.
It was a fun process. People would be sitting and writing by hand, and someone else that knows how to type would type it for them.
The underground paper projected a definite in-your-face attitude. Next to the masthead, there's a cartoon of a general saying, "This here's rotten commie subversive propaganda.
And I don't want to catch any of you clowns reading it."
There was also serious news about the war and the growing opposition to it within the military.
Bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting.
The newspaper was to the anti-war movement what the M16 was to the war. That was your weapon. That was your voice. That was, without the electronic technology we have today, there was more of a real need for the newsprint. And to distribute it on base was a mission, in a sense. It was like going on a patrol in the jungle, except you weren't going to get shot, but you might end up in the stockade.
I am General Paul D. Hawkins, commander of the U.S. Military Assistance Command in Vietnam. Here today, the U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines are joined together in a common effort to help this country.
This particular issue in my hand has a headline, Jane Fonda Banned from Fort.
That's right, Jane Fonda, actress and anti-war activist. In the spring of 1970, she was on a listening tour.
So we took her out to Fort Lewis just to talk to GIs. It was an open post at the time. It was legal for anybody to go on base without having to check in.
Easy access or not, they soon found themselves surrounded by military police, detained, fingerprinted.
Was it kind of exciting? You're here with Jane Fonda, famous Jane Fonda.
Yeah, I was
getting
a little bit taken aback by it, as were the GIs. I mean, you know, you're young men in your late teens, early 20s, and this beautiful kind of sexy star comes along.
Anderson ended up being expelled for life from Fort Lewis. When he asked why, they said it was because he was on post with Jane Fonda. He says it illustrates what the mood was like in the country at the time.
You don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Medevac helicopters could not find a safe landing zone out of enemy mortar.
By 1971, nearly 54,000 Americans had died in the war. The draft meant that every male between the ages of 18 and 26 had a good chance of being sent to Vietnam.
An Allied force of more than 8,000 men today tightened its hold on the Batangan Peninsula on South Vietnam's central coast.
News of the anti-war movement was front and center.
Something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear.
It was in this environment that the GI underground newspapers flourished and that Fed Up was being secretly distributed at Fort Lewis.
My name is Bruce McLean, and I'm an attorney here in Ballard.
Bruce McLean wrote for and helped distribute the underground newspaper. He was drafted right out of college and was at Fort Lewis fighting orders to go to Vietnam. He says he'd sneak the papers onto the post and then try to pass them along to fellow soldiers who seemed receptive.
There was a look. People that tried to cheat on whether their hair could be over the ears or their mustache could be below the corner of their lip.
Kind of showed you as a rebel.
Made you a hippie, yeah.
As for if he ever got fooled by someone pretending to be anti-war who was really feeding information up the chain of command, he says, oh yeah.
I have since seen my FBI file that makes that quite clear, that there were agent provocateurs, we called them at the time.
Civilians also did their part to get the paper into the hands of soldiers. Stan Anderson recruited teenagers. Most got caught right away, but he says there were these two kids from Seattle.
They never got caught. They even got fed up into the firing range, into the foxholes. So when the GIs report in the morning from basic training for a rifle practice, they'd find this fed up in the foxhole. What's this? And at that time, we're talking about late 60s, early 70s, the youth was political. I mean, you could find high school kids through college that were interested in everything going on and wanted to be part of it. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for?
Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. Magon Cornish had just graduated from Cornell in 1972 when she and a group of friends traveled to Tacoma and became part of the collective that was running the Shelter Half Coffee House and helping to put out the underground paper.
We called ourselves the People's Trucking Company because we had traveled across country in an old post office van.
Like a lot of 20-somethings at the time, Cornish was itching to be part of the movement. Although she'd grown up an army brat, she'd turned against the war, and this, she said, felt like concrete rebellion.
It was one of the few areas in the anti-war movement where you could feel like you were really having a role, other than going to marches, you know, you're really having a role in opposing the war.
Oh, I also have over here a piece of the Shelter Half.
Stan Anderson says he'd gotten involved in the anti-war movement while he was still in the military. He'd been drafted into the Army, trained on helicopters, and although he didn't end up being shipped overseas, he never forgot what officers told him in training.
They said, you're going to fly into areas where you're going to have to shoot to kill every man, woman, and child, regardless of age. If they're moving, you shoot to kill. Somebody raised their hand. Well, how do you know if they're the enemy? The answer was, if you hit them, they're the enemy. Well, a lot of us to that was just something you could not live with.
Yesterday, the Allies killed 23 of the enemy and captured...
At the coffee house, there were a lot of conversations between guys who'd been to war and those about to go.
And you'd see that kind of enlightenment taking place already in somebody that had joined and is just being overwhelmed with the stories that they're hearing.
The war ended, the draft went away, times changed. The GI Coffee House closed, and the last edition of the underground newspaper Fed Up was published in 1973.
KPLU Law and Justice reporter Paula Whistle. Still to come, some anti-gay rights protesters discover that they've messed with the wrong drag queen. That's coming up right here on Sound Effect. Don't go away. Welcome back to Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. It's our newsroom episode, and now we're on to Chapter 4, Environment. If you live in the city, you can feel pretty separate from nature, and that's why trees are so important to the urban environment. They provide shade and habitat and fresh air. Everybody loves trees, right? Well, you love them until they fall on your house, or on your car, or on your skull. You see, in cities with so many people and buildings and nature all growing together, somebody has got to go and tend to those trees. They have to keep them healthy and keep them off power lines, and sometimes they have to put them out of their misery before they kill somebody. So this is what arborists do. It's hard work, often involving heavy equipment, and it's long been dominated by men. But that's changing. KPLU's Bellamy Palethorpe went out to West Seattle to meet one of the pioneering women in the field, Kathy Holzer.
There's a bright yellow truck on a street in West Seattle. Nearby is a small group of people in hard hats, some on the ground and some up in trees.
Hi, I didn't bring a helmet. Do you have an extra one?
A family has just moved into a new home, and they're working with Out on a Limb Tree Company, founded by Kathy Holzer. She's the one with the chainsaw about 40 feet above us in a black pine tree. It's a removal, so there'll be more room for children to play on the grass strip between two houses. She's got spikes on her boots and a chainsaw swinging from her hip. Some blocks of wood and pulleys are part of the rigging. It's intricate work as she swings around and cuts from the top down, carefully maneuvering her way to the ground and casting off limbs to the crew below.
I do still like doing removals that are complicated. You have to think about like which piece comes out first and where it's going to land and how much it weighs and where you need to have the reading lines and where the block goes, and all of that complexity is good brain workout, and it requires agility as well.
She's super strong, but also light. Arborists, as they're called, are often smaller people with lots of upper body strength. Imagine a rock climber, only on trees.
I guess my favorite thing about being an arborist has always been that it used all aspects of my personality. So it's a workout physically. It forces you to come to the present moment, because if you can't be in the present moment and you're aloft, you're going to get hurt eventually. You're not going to be a lifer in the industry. You have to have the ability to show up all the way.
It's dangerous work, has some of the highest injury rates of any profession, but she likes it.
It requires creativity to do a good job. It requires a lot of information about tree biology and the effect of your actions on this particular tree based on age, species, vigor, time of year.
Oh, what did you just do?
It's just smelling a fir stub. The sap is all over it, and it smells really good. That's the visceral part. You gotta love trees to do this job. It's too hard and dangerous and not lucrative enough to do for any other reason.
Kathy just turned 50. She says she's known since she was little that being outdoors makes her happy. She grew up in her parents' apple orchards near Chicago.
And I was a kid that, you know, was always up in a tree and the dog was lying under the tree and they'd know where I was because there was the dog, so I must be in that tree. And I always broke out the dead branches that were in my way because it really seemed intuitively that the tree didn't need them. And so my poor dad would come to cut the grass and there'd be like piles of dead branches under the trees that I'd been climbing. Who's been doing that? And so when they sent me to a pruning class, I was like, well, this is a no-brainer. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. I mean, my last name in German apparently means woodcutter.
But this woodcutter is getting older. She doesn't climb as much as when she started in her 30s.
And there's been quite a bit of wear and tear for me physically. I also really desperately miss it.
She's in the trees 2 days a week now, does bids and runs the office the other two. She has to keep enough work coming in to sustain her company and support her crew.
It's not visceral anymore. It's more kind of strategic in terms of educating people, selling the work that I want to do, that I believe needs to be done.
Climbing trees with sharp saws and harnesses is hard to learn, and for a woman, you have to have a special kind of tough. That's why Kathy says the best way to learn this profession is to compete in the tree climbing circuit. It's put on by the International Society of Arboriculture and draws tree climbers from all over the world.
And in 2000, the chapter approached me and they said, hey, you gotta compete. And I said, what, are you kidding me? I just started a business. I don't have time to go to the bathroom. I can't do this. And then I think it was 2001 that the competition was actually at Volunteer Park in Seattle. And I went and watched, and I saw two women who are now friends of mine from Australia and Toronto duking it out for the world title. And I watched and I thought, I can do that. And the next thought was, well, I should do that because there need to be women in this industry more visible. It needs to be demonstrated that women can be fearless and strong and agile.
Now she's handing off to the next generation. 25-year-old Alex Ayers is an apprentice who's been with Kathy for 2 years and sports a mohawk. Alex recently tattooed her knuckles with the letters that spell out tree life. She's using her lunch hour to study and get ready for a big exam because now she's about to get certified.
So next month I can go up to Canada. Actually, I'm going to go to BC and take the written arborist certification exam and become certified. Be a professional.
Lunch is over and it's time to get back to the trees. Kathy picks up her climbing saddle and gets ready to finish taking down that pine.
KPLU environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe brought us that story. It's Sound Effect on KPLU, our special newsroom edition, and now we're on to Chapter 5, Human Interest. So for this story, I'm welcoming KPLU's Ed Ronco in here to reintroduce us to a person that he profiled, somebody who's a bit of a maverick, not unlike Ed himself. Hey, Ed.
Hi, Gabriel. Okay, so we're going to hear from a Seattle drag queen whose name, in and of itself, might break a rule, at least maybe the rules of polite society. We should tell you, in this segment, we're going to address some adult topics, beginning with her name, actually. Now, this drag queen is the creation of a guy named Brian Peters, performs each Sunday on Capitol Hill, is about to go out on a big tour, by the way, and her name is Mama Tits.
Okay.
So for those of you who've never been out here before, we are a crazy, wild, irreverent show, if you haven't figured out. I am goodness and light. I am nothing but sweet purity up here. And I will take you on this journey. It's everybody else you gotta watch out for. They're trash.
Could you describe yourself physically for people who can't see you?
Well, I'm 6'6". I weigh more than 250 pounds, but I actually wear my weight pretty evenly, thank God. So I'm big, stocky. I look like a linebacker, and my boobs are 44 triple D.
Oh, I forgot to tell you, I'm a dude. So if that changes things.
Do you consider yourself a rule breaker?
Completely. I'm one of those people that just because you tell me that that's the way things should be doesn't mean that I believe it. You know, I grew up in San Jose, Cupertino, San Rafael, and then we moved out later into Stockton, California. And, you know, I was one of four white kids. So it's like I've been on that end of it. I've been the first out gay male in my high school's history in Nampa, Idaho, when we left California and went to Idaho. Whoa. And I don't follow what I guess societal norm is. I just kind of follow the tune of my own drummer. And sometimes it gets me in trouble. Sometimes it doesn't. You know, it's not what you say, it's how you say it.
Is performing in drag part of how you say it?
Oh, my goodness. The way that drag is that I can then take myself, and aside from just wearing fabulous clothes and wigs and whatnot, I've completely covered who I am. And I wear this mask, and this mask of this character gives me this power of anonymity. And it's something I learned from being a Sister of Perpetual Indulgence, which is an organization based on rule breaking.
And the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, this is, just to clarify, a group that was founded in San Francisco. They dress up in drag as nuns and then go out into the streets and do good works.
They were the first ones to do the first candlelight vigil for AIDS victims. They were the first ones to organize pretty much everything that has happened in HIV/AIDS awareness and activism since it began in 1979. That was my what I consider boot camp. It was my going to university. Because you can be angry about something and you can have something really upset you and you can want to make a change. But if you go about it the wrong way, you're going to do nothing but hinder your cause. If you do it the right way, you will further it.
So I want to ask you about the Pride Parade, the most recent Pride Parade. You confronted some protesters that came down the street before the parade started. Describe what happened from your point of view.
This is the fifth year that I've hosted the Seattle Pride Parade. It's been a huge honor. They asked me as a sister 5 years ago. Sylvia Ostafermore actually asked me to join her. This year, we were invited to do Westlake Center, which was the pinnacle of the parade. And it's a huge honor. And we're in the pause between the pre-show and the actual parade. And I look down and I see these signs come around the corner and I say to myself, I'm like, oh, hell no, because I can read these yellow signs that say, repent for your sins. And it was just all these little Bible-esque quotes of just damnation.
You thought that they had just kind of entered the parade route?
I thought they had just crashed the parade. I didn't find out that they had had a permit until weeks later. So I see them come around the corner, and I was livid. Mind you, I was in blue hair, aqua blue sequin dress, and a glitter rainbow on my boobs. And the next thing I know, they're in front of me. So I literally just throw my arms out as if I'm being nailed to a cross so that I'm a wall, a human wall.
Well, you had this confrontation.
So he comes up and I get out, my arms are outstretched and I'm like, no, you're not passing me. And I keep jumping in front of him every time he tries to dodge me. And I was doing it to antagonize him. So Seattle police would remove him. He got so frustrated with me, he ended up pushing on me. There was that moment where the photo captures me stepping to him. And then there's another photo of him just pressing on me. And right after that photo was snapped, he whacks me in the head with his sign. So I toss his sign out of his face and I let him go. And he walked up to the end and he ran into the Dykes on Bikes, which are the head of the Seattle Pride Parade, and they wouldn't let him pass. So he turned around, and then is when the video starts picking up.
Why don't you read your own book and actually follow the teachings to the letter of God and learn to support and love? You need to drop the hate. You are a sad, sad excuse for a human being. Once you learn to drop the hate, you too can find happiness, because we will welcome you in
What are you thinking as this is happening?
Be completely accountable for everything that you say.
Explain that.
The reason why I was mad at this man was he was not being accountable for the words that were coming out of his mouth. He was spewing vitriol and hate. And what I imagine in my head is the one person in the crowd, behind the crowd, this is the last thing they needed to hear. And they were trying to come out to a parade to be okay with themselves. Then they hear this. And they go commit suicide. Or what about that person who hears it and they're like, that's all I needed, and they go do a gay bashing? Or what about the parent who is there trying to support their kid, but they hear this, and then they're like, you know what, I can't do this. You're going to go to hell. And then now this kid doesn't have any family that loves and supports them. That's why I was angry. Because I was like, you have commandeered our parade. We don't go to your revival and come in and start spewing how evil and nasty you are. We leave you alone. But you decide to come to our event that we have paid the city for, that we have permitted legally, that we have every right to do. And if you want your own, go ahead, do your own. Obviously, he could. But he couldn't get an audience. So he wanted to steal our audience. And that's what angered me, is I was like, why would you do that?
The YouTube clip, as of December, has like 1.8 million hits, give or take. Has it changed things for Mama or for Brian?
Wow. I woke up Monday morning, and everybody knew who I was. It went global. I was just thinking about the fact that this man had upset me and he was not being accountable for his words, and I wanted him to be accountable, and I didn't want everybody to hear his hate. I was like, this is not what this is about. And then to wake up in the morning and have it hit so many people, it's truly humbling. It's like, holy God.
It affected you too.
Yeah. It was an extremely emotional day. Because I think of all of the people that have had to deal with this hate and didn't feel supported. All of the people that feel worthless. All the people that feel like something's wrong with them because they're not the way that somebody else told them that they should be. And it hurts me because I am proud to be a freak. I am proud to be a faggot. I am proud to be a queen. And through that, I am proud to be a survivor of abuse and HIV. I am proud of all of these things. I am not ashamed, and I don't want anybody else to be.
Brian Peters, also known as the drag queen Mama Tits, talking with KPLU's Ed Ronco. He performs each Sunday afternoon at Mimosas with Mama inside the Unicorn Narwhal on Seattle's Capitol Hill. We have pictures and a much longer conversation with Brian Peters on our website, kplu.org. Before we wrap up our special newsroom episode, here's an epilogue. Let's go back one more time to that Monday news meeting. You'll remember that's where news director Aaron Hennessy gives us our marching orders each week. And as of recently, we have a new piece of our job description, saving KPLU.
Well, I'll give you my personal for me, I don't like talking about fundraising. I'm a news director. And
as KPLU's fate plays out, it's worth mentioning that the newsroom, what we've been talking about for this whole past hour, is one of the things that hangs in the balance. So I thought we'd get an update on where things stand with it. I asked the big boss, General Manager Joey Cohn, to pop in and bring us up to date. But first, just to, you know, warm him up, I asked him what he was doing before he joined KPLU, which was 28 years ago.
I'm sorry, you're going to have to repeat that. You were a VJ on a local MTV formatted station, which is a thing.
Yeah.
What era would this have been?
The 40s.
The heyday of MTV.
It was, you know, like 84.
And I assume that local MTV formatted station is still alive, well, and thriving and winning awards and everything?
It became a Warner Brothers affiliate.
Okay.
Warner Brothers bought them.
You've worked at a lot of stations before you came to KPLU.
Right. Worked in commercial radio, worked in commercial television.
In commercial media especially, things come and go a lot. People are getting used to stuff changing. People are getting used to things that they like or are familiar with going away. So what would be lost if we were to lose KPLU?
We just have very talented people on staff, people that are curious and want to tell good stories and want to make a difference.
The first announcement was that KPLU was going to be sold to the University of Washington. The programming that people hear on this station would be replaced by a 24-hour music service. What's changed since then?
There was a huge outcry. And because of that, the universities said, you know what? Let's let the public then make an offer. And so that's what is going on now. Fundraising has started about 2 weeks ago, and we're closing in on $1 million.
How much money do we need to raise?
From what we've been told, $7 million cash. We feel that it's very doable.
So much of the work we do is in like the kind of room we're in now, like a little soundproofed studio. And we kind of trust that people are listening, but we don't always sort of hear back from listeners who we might have impacted. And this process has brought a lot of that into the light. What's that been like for you to get so much feedback in?
When you're somebody who's worked in radio a long time, you know, it's kind of like you're talking to yourself. Somebody once asked me what it's like being on the radio. I said, do you like leaving messages on answering machines? You know,
you've got what it takes.
Yeah, you could have a future in broadcasting. You never know. The thing about being on the radio is you never know who's listening, and you never know the effect that you have on them.
We had this big public meeting shortly after the announcement when it looked for sure like we were goners, and people lined up a dozen deep to speak, you know, just to make their voice heard. There wasn't really anything we could do. People just wanted to be heard. And then there was this one woman in particular who came up and basically only talked for like 10 seconds. And she just said, I'm married to a member of the military. He's a special forces service member, and he's gone for long periods of time. And it's very frightening. And I've spent many a long frightened nights with KPLU, and KPLU's been my comfort and got me through it, and thank you. And then she just turned around and left. She didn't even say her name. And it was just gorgeous. It struck me how we really are in people's lives in ways that we don't always even know, but it's there.
It's so true. It shows me that embracing the community even more and having the community be a bigger part of this radio station on an ongoing basis is very important for our future.
So, Joey, what do people do if they want to learn about how they can actually help save KPLU?
You personally can make a huge difference by donating to the Save KPLU Fund. And all the information is at kplu.org. And we're all going to do this together, and KPLU will become a community station and an independent station. And thank you very much.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Gabe.
That's KPLU General Manager Joey Cohn. Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwin Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad, with additional production from Warren Langford. Our warmest appreciation to the reporters who have contributed stories here, Paula Whistle, Jennifer Wing, Ashley Gross, Bellamy Palethorpe, and Ed Ronco. We get web help from Dave Nagaris, and driving us ever onward is executive producer Aaron Hennessy. And special thanks this week to Joey Cohn, Matt Martinez, Stephen Tan, and all of the people spearheading the Save KPLU movement. You can learn more about that effort and about our show at kplusoundeffect.org.
We're also on iTunes and Facebook, and you can tweet feedback at KPLU or email soundeffect@kplu.org. And be sure to come back next week. We are going solo.
Everyone feels lonely at some point, but this was like a very desperate feeling of isolation. I knew no one could hear me, you know, if I were crying or if I screamed.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.